It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hey, this is Trillions Presents The ETF Story. I'm Joel Weber, and I'm the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. During this series, we've been tracing the story of the exchange-traded fund, from its origin in the SEC's 1987 Market Break Report, to building its legal structure, to finally bringing it to market. Today, it remains the largest ETF, with $270 billion in assets. But when SPY first launched in 1993, let's just say it didn't exactly take the world by storm. Gary Eisenrich is a managing partner at Fairfield Advisors. At the time of SPY's launch, he was a specialist at Spear, Leeds, and Kellogg, tasked with providing liquidity as the product's first market maker. A market maker is someone who matches buyers and sellers and then takes a small cut. On its first day, SPY traded about 1 million shares, and Eisenrich says there was a lot of fanfare.
There was the big spider, and there was all the T-shirts and the hats and a lot of dignitaries and a lot of people because it was a new issue. And then they put up the first print. It was 200 shares, and they had it on the ticker tape. I've got a copy of it, and they had a few of those. And so I have the initial thing, and then some initial orders happen, and then it just sat.
Yep, it just sat.
Then over the next 6 months, the volume went down very rapidly to where it was trading 18,000 shares a day.
Eric Balchunas, an ETF analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence and our resident historian, says it was disappointing, and rumors about whether SPY would live on began to spread.
So it kind of had this big hype first day, but then it kind of trailed off. And I don't know if they were looking to close it. I heard that, but I'm not sure if that's totally true.
In fact, I had a number of people saying, Gary, you're wasting your time. It's not going to make it. But I really felt strongly that it was a good enough product. It was only 25 basis points. And to be able to go in and trade that intraday was great. So getting it adopted was the hard part.
So how'd they do it? How did SPY go from trading 18,000 shares a day to being the world's largest ETF? Gary Eisenrich was leading these guerrilla marketing efforts. He said he was able to sell people on Spider's structure. And when those people had success with it, they ended up telling others.
Besides, if they have a good experience trading 100 shares, they're going to tell the guy that's going to trade 10,000 shares. And that's basically how Spider's was, from word of mouth and a cheap product. And people that, money managers, that didn't want to buy an expensive product that had an embedded 100 basis points, they wanted to have it at 25 basis points.
And it sort of had to be word of mouth, because brokers had no incentive to sell SPY. So he hit the road with people from the American Stock Exchange, or Amex, to talk about SPY.
And it was a sale on the Amex, too. I mean, it didn't have the best reputation of that, and I don't know that that was warranted at all, but I would go to people places and they say, I'm not trading on the Amex. But to get that going, and after a while you would talk to people and say, I will make you a fair market and trade. So it caught on because people were happy with the experience they were having. They were happy with the return that they were getting.
Eric says people, including Eisenrich, who were advocating for SPY early on, were true believers in the product. And that got things moving.
That's important because repetition, guerrilla marketing, that stuff matters. But then you need that plus some kind of an outside catalyst. And the outside catalyst was the 90s economy kicked in right around 94, 95. And that's just a good year to be offering S&P 500 exposure. So you had that outside catalyst mixed in with the guerrilla marketing at the bottom from true believers. And that's when you started to see the assets grow. And then from there, it basically doubled its assets every year for the next, whatever, decade.
whether it's a happy accident or whether it was the hard work of the folks at the Amex really getting everybody to play ball at the same time for their own, you know, enlightened self-interest reasons, it wouldn't have ever worked.
Dave Nodig, the longtime managing director of ETF.com, says there was skepticism lurking in the background as SPY and others moved into the marketplace.
The skepticism was around whether or not you would ever get both sides of the market to participate. And what I mean by that is you had to have institutions willing to buy these things, willing to buy SPY to get their S&P 500 exposure. But at the same time, you needed to have people willing to be market makers and authorized participants that would arbitrage out price discrepancies. And I will admit, in 1992, when I first started wading into this, I was enormously skeptical that that second part would show up, because there is a real chicken and the egg problem, right? If you only end up with one institution that buys $50 million of them and then they never trade again, then the second side, that AP and market maker side, never comes online and the whole thing's a failure.
So once SPY kind of took off and other people thought to use this structure in track other things, not just the S&P 500. So one of those things was international. And so they had a line of ETFs from Morgan Stanley that came out that were called WEBs.
Bob Toll began working with Nate Most on this very project for Morgan Stanley.
So Nate and I start formulating what became eventually the filing for WEBs. I have to work with Nate because he's so far advanced in the thinking compared to anybody else at Morgan Stanley even. So it's probably October 93, we get back together after the summer, and we're going to take and create what we know from our commodities world is a receipt. We draft the prospectus. We work with the lawyers from Sullivan and Cromwell. And lo and behold, we design the filing that goes in. And it's World Equity Benchmark Shares.
Hence, WEBs.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Toll says he was very strategic about presenting this new WEBs product. He and Nate Most carefully educated people about what the product would really look like.
One of the things that was so paramount in our thought process was that we wanted ETFs to be a no-fail environment. Even though we were trading international securities and packaging them all up, we didn't want to fail.
Long story short, SPY was always known as the spiders. Even when MDY came out, that was also sort of the spiders. That was just what they called them. So when Morgan Stanley wanted to put out something that used this structure, but they wanted to have it track international markets, you know, like Brazil and Mexico and that kind of thing, because traders like to trade the whole country at once and not just pick a stock. When they came out with their idea for these international type ETFs, they couldn't use Spider because that's the State Street name.
So they said, you got to come up with a different term so that there's no investor confusion. So the first use of the name exchange traded funds is in the web prospectus because we had to create something different.
And so that's what's interesting is that the acronym and the name wasn't really put out there until 6 years after Bloom and Most, you know, actually filed for it.
WEBs was important because it coined the term exchange-traded fund. But it was also significant because WEBs was driven by client demand. Nodig says unlike SPY, which was innovation-driven, WEBs was addressing specific demands.
WEBs was Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, realizing that there was this demand from a sophisticated institutional trading market that wanted exposure to international markets in a way that they couldn't get access. And the reason they couldn't get access was primarily a custody problem. Back in those days, if you wanted to trade Argentina, which I think was one of the very first ones in the sleeve, you had to have a local desk that knew how to trade Argentina. You had to have a local bank that was going to custody those assets. Maybe, you know, Bank of New York might have an affiliate relationship with somebody down there. But it was a pain in the neck to include Argentina in your international portfolio. And MSCI was really trying to build out, or then Morgan Stanley was really trying to build out their international chops, if you will. And so what they did was solicit from their biggest clients, where do you want to trade? And so you look at that list of the 15 or 16 initial webs products, it's a bizarre list.
Also, this structure, although it followed the same wrapper concept as SPY, didn't follow the same unit investment trust or UIT structure.
Well, the UIT structure is extremely restrictive, right? And for the S&P 500, it makes a ton of sense because you're never going to not own one of the 500 stocks in the S&P 500. They're all liquid. Everybody obviously wants all that exposure.
So instead, Webbs used mutual funds because mutual funds were less limiting than a UIT when working with international markets.
When you talk about Argentina, it's a little bit different. And the custody issues in some of those countries were, in the mid-90s, still intractable. I mean, I literally remember a phone call in the mid-90s with our custodian bank in India at Wells Fargo Nico, who was talking about the fact that we had to decay a whole bunch of trades because the courier got hit by a truck. And all of the trades were on a paper in a knapsack going between the brokerage and the custody shop. So, like, that's the kind of stuff we were dealing with. So in that environment, you had to have some latitude. Again, not that you weren't managing an index fund. You were managing an index fund. But I think there's a misconception that managing an index fund means that you own precisely everything exactly when you're supposed to at exactly the right price. And that's just not true unless you're a UIT, in which case you have to do it that way.
Bob Toll says the managing director at Morgan Stanley didn't think ETFs would amount to anything, so he was happy to unload them. Eventually, Barclays Global Investors bought Webbs from Morgan Stanley, and it was a steal.
A dollar, if I remember correctly.
A dollar.
Yeah. I had to have four phone calls with Bob Diamond, who was the president of Barclays in London, who was ex-Morgan Stanley and a friend of mine, and he calls me four times to say, you know, what are they trying to do to me? You know, where's the landmine, right? And I'm going, just buy it. I said, what do you want as Barclays? He said, we don't have a retail footprint in the United States, the largest capital markets in the world, and nobody knows Barclays from iota, right? BGI is named that. But if you asked a person on the street who the heck Barclays Bank was, they'd look at you like, I don't know. So here was the golden opportunity for Barclays to develop a retail brand in the United States for a dollar and get paid for doing it.
Webbs eventually became iShares after the Barclays acquisition. And Nodick says this is when the brand really started to change.
And one of the consultants working in that process was a guy named Lee Cranefiss. He was a consultant as part of that process working with Patty Dunn, who would later become the head of BGI. And, you know, he, I think, recognized even more than me or any of the people who were in the business at the time that these products were actually a solution not just for those big institutions and not just for people who needed to equitize cash, but they were products that could solve real long-term asset allocation investment needs for clients, and was really the guy who pushed for the rebranding of those into what is inarguably a more retail brand, iShares.
Toll says Lee Cranefiss was lucky to be in the position he was in as iShares became more retail-focused, but he wasn't the only reason for its success.
It was the money that the Amex kept telling him to spend, right? And so what's Lee do? He tries a couple of things. If you remember, at one point, every bus stop in lower Manhattan from NYU South had an iShares sign on it. And people kept saying, what is iShares? Right? Then they started sponsoring Cirque du Soleil events. And then so they were targeting, in my opinion, Lee got the luck of the draw. The real brains who I think deserves tremendous amount of credit is Bruce Levine, Jim Polison, Craig Friedman. All of those guys saw the vision of how to convert basically an institutional money manager, which was the old Wells Fargo Investment Advisors, into a retail brand name.
Today, iShares, which is now owned by BlackRock, is the largest ETF brand. Nodig says when you step back and think about it, SPY paved the way for iShares.
If SPY had come out and continued to fail and not gotten any traction, I don't think there would have been a lot of move to push WEBS forward. Even so, it's a little bit of a miracle to me that WEBS ever launched. It wasn't something that I recall at the time there was a tremendous amount of management enthusiasm and excitement about. It was seen as sort of a bit of a flyer that we were doing to service a bunch of very high-end customers.
Nodig says it took a while for these products to start catching on, but they did, and there was a massive shift in how people started thinking about investing.
And it wouldn't be, honestly, I think, until the early 2000s where most people started realizing, holy cats, these things really can change how we think about investing.
He says the same goes for him personally. He was on those original marketing teams for iShares, but it wasn't until he actually used an ETF himself that he got it.
I was not one of those guys that recognized greatness and jumped in. I'm not going to claim any of that. It wasn't until I was sitting on a trading desk and all of a sudden I could like hit a button and get $1 million exposure to the Qs. I was all in.
Next time on Trillions Presents, the ETF keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
It got to $1 billion in 3 days. That's a record, as you know. It's the, I call it the Joe DiMaggio hitting streak.
Is it still the standing record?
Easily.
Is it?
Okay. You know what number two is? Can you guess?
BOND?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, that's yeah. True nerddom right there. Hardly anybody knows that.
Thanks for listening to the ETF Story. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. The ETF Story is produced by Jordan Bell, with some production help by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.